From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Hundreds of millions of voters participated in last weekend's European Union elections for more than 700 representatives elected from 24 different countries. The EU's political structure has for decades been dominated by centrists, right and left parties. But on May 26th, that center fell apart as right-wing nationalist parties surged, but also leftist parties like the Greens. What do the election results mean for Europe and its relationship to the world? And do they suggest a realignment of Europe's political direction? To answer that question, we go to Paris, France, to speak with Jean Briquemont. He is a retired mathematical and statistical physicist from the University of Louvain. He's the author of Humanitarian Imperialism, Using Human Rights to Sell War, and co-author of Fashionable Nonsense, Postmodern Intellectuals' Abuse of Science. Welcome to the program, Jean.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So first, just because we're here in the United States and the EU's election system is very unique in the world, can you begin by giving us a brief description of how this works? We're not talking about people voting for representatives in their own country, but voting for representatives to a parliament of governments, right?
Yes. But you see, you must understand that the European Parliament is nothing like the US Congress. It doesn't have the right to initiate laws, and it doesn't have much power actually at all. The power is in the hand of the Commission, which is an unelected body. And also, the European Union is mostly run by treaties, and there is a court of justice that checks the treaties are being applied. So this is the most undemocratic system that you can think in the so-called democratic world. Of course, there is no dictator. In fact, there is no, maybe it would be better if there was somebody in charge, but it's just a bureaucracy which is in charge, and you know, judges and so on. There is no real leader, there is no real policy, there is no real thinking, and it's a big, in my view, the European Parliament is a big illusion. You have the illusion of democracy, and there is no democracy. And of course, I don't know all the European languages, but I know French, and I've been following the elections both in Belgium and France. And I can assure you that all those elections are purely national elections. People vote on the basis of whom they like and they don't like on the national level. Nobody gives, you know, what word I should use? Nobody gives a damn about the European Parliament or the European construction. There is no such thing as a European people. It's not under construction. And without a people, there won't be any democracy. I think that's a fact. I think it's a fact which Americans don't like to hear because they have a romantic view of the European construction as being somehow the people of Europe being united and so on. I'm sorry, there is no such thing.
So what does the European Union elected body actually control? I mean, there is a budget. They do, I understand, there is a set of laws that they do help to shape, right?
Oh, no, they can check certain decisions, but they have very little power. They have no, you know, any parliament in the world has the right to initiate laws. The European Parliament does not have that right. I don't know exactly what their powers are, because on top of being rather powerless, you see, they couldn't have, they couldn't have a real parliament for the following reason. They couldn't have a real government, because if you have a parliament, then there is a government responsible to the parliament. Now, imagine a government when there is not a single Hungarian, a single Belgian, a single Dane, a single Portuguese. People of those countries wouldn't allow that, okay? You can have a U.S. government without anybody from Connecticut because everybody is American in the United States. But that's not the case in Europe. So if you had a parliament without anybody from one of those countries, it wouldn't be allowed. If you have a government with people from all those countries, then you would have to a lot of people from the big countries like Germany, Italy, France, etc., because they wouldn't want to have one representative either. So it's just impossible. De Gaulle made it very clear in the 60s. He says there is no way that you can have France governed by a majority which is based on the German and Italian and so on, other non-French people. And the same thing for other countries. So there's just the fact that there's no people, you see, something which people say, oh, that's nationalism. This is just realism. I mean, people in Europe exist, they're different, they don't have the same language, they're not fused like in the United States, and there is no way that you can have a real democracy at the European level. And the whole point of the European construction is to destroy the democracies that existed at the national level. Because now the government at the national level have very little power because all their decisions have to be in agreement with the treaties, and the treaties, whether you are in agreement with the treaties or not, is decided by the European Court of Justice. Not to be confused with the Human Rights Court. This is just a court that decides on all the, you know, basically economic measures that are taken in the European Union. So we are stuck in a situation where we are going to be, more and more in this neoliberal model, which is in a sense more radical even than the US model.
So then would you say that the greatest significance of these results is a sort of symbolism as to who may be popular among those who show up to vote?
Yes, but you see, you mentioned the Greens to being on the left. Well, of course, they are usually defined as such, but to me, they are really very right-wing because they are absolutely for the European project, which means they are against democracy. In every recent war, like in Libya or in Syria and so on, they've been adamantly on the side of what I call humanitarian imperialism.
And this is the Green Party, which won big in Germany.
Well, certainly the Greens, I don't know the Greens in every country, but in Germany and France, that was certainly true. With Fischer, Cohn-Bendit and so on, they were enthusiastic about the Kosovo War. Then they were enthusiastic about the Libyan War. Maybe not the war in Iraq, because that was viewed not as humanitarian, but they were also for the Afghan war and, of course, intervention in Syria. I mean, they have swallowed the human rights right to the human rights ideology that gives all these countries the right to intervene everywhere they want. So in that sense, I think, and they're also very much for censorship and politically correct and so on. I don't like them at all. I think they are terrible. But, of course, you see, the problem is that the left, mostly under the influence of this ideology, has totally swallowed the idea that the nation state should be destroyed and replaced by the European construction, namely a supranational construction, not a new nation, but a supranational construction, which by definition has to be undemocratic and bureaucratic. Once they have done that, then they have opened the way for what we call the far right. I don't like this word because these people have really nothing to do with the far right in the 30s. But anyway, let's call it the far right, to rise up and defend national sovereignty. Since they are the ones who defend national sovereignty, then we are in the worst possible situation, where we have the pseudo-left to defend the destruction of the nation state and the European construction, and denounce it as nationalist, fascist, racist, etc. Anybody who supports the nation state and therefore democracy. And then on the other side, you have the far right, which is pretending, they're not even serious about that, but they pretend to defend national sovereignty. So we are between a rock and a hard place, and we are in the worst possible situation. But the left has created that because what I call the pseudo-left has created that because they are the ones who have decided to give up, to destroy the nation state. Instead of building socialism, they have decided to build Europe, the European construction. So that's a disaster.
So would you then say that the Greens have essentially begun adopting, or it sounds like they've begun adopting, the centrism of the center-left, or what have been deemed the center-left parties, such as Emmanuel Macron in France, except maybe stronger on climate issues?
Sure, of course. They have nothing to do with the Greens in the United States. I know the Green Party in the United States. I know Jill Stein and I like her. You know, they have nothing to do with that. I mean, they are far more aggressive with respect to Russia than Jill Stein the peace candidate in the United States. They're not at all like anybody progressive in the United States. They have nothing to do with that because the Greens in the United States are light years away from getting into a power position. But the Greens, no. The Greens are in parliament. They have been in several governments, in Germany, in France, in Belgium. They're very powerful there. And of course, then they become institutionalized just the way the Social Democrat became before, and even the Communists became before. So, I mean, once you get, power corrupt, so as long as you're in the opposition, you can be nice, but like Jill Stein or,
So, Jean, what does the rise of the right-wing nationalist parties mean? Some have suggested that even though they did show some gains, they didn't win enough to really shape any agenda. In Britain, we saw the Brexit parties win. In Italy, we saw right-wing parties. And also in France with Marine Le Pen's party, right?
Nothing they can do at the European Parliament. You could have a majority of the right-wing party. That wouldn't change very much at the European Parliament. The point is also, it's a bit of a delusion because, for example, if you take the party of Orban in Hungary, which is denounced as far-right, he insists that he wants to remain within the, you know, the popular party, which is the party of the social, the Christian Democrat and the traditional right-wing party. So, and the Polish right-wing is also in that party. So that European party contains things that at a national level would be considered far-right. So it's a bit a delusion to say that, oh, but the far-right is not that big in the European Parliament because there are these parties which insist to be in the mainstream conservative bloc, even though they would be labeled far-right in their own country. But you see, there's no way to fight this far-right if you don't deal with the issue of national sovereignty. National sovereignty is not a bad word. Every third world country struggle was for national sovereignty. The Palestinian fight for national sovereignty. This idea of the left that in Europe we have to destroy national sovereignty and transfer power in effect to an unelected bureaucracy is the most catastrophic idea that the new left has had since the 60s. And it is the idea that they have had. I mean, Mitterrand and all these people. I mean, I don't know if it's the new left. I think, is it, I try to convey this message to Americans because I think Americans idealize the European construction much too much.
Now, you're in France. Specifically, can you explain what has happened within France and why Macron's party seemed to lose out to Marine Le Pen's party in the EU elections? Has Macron really been, you know, lost political clout, in particular because of the massive yellow vest protests that have gone on for months now?
No, I don't think so. First of all, I think it's a victory for Macron. Macron has oriented against all rules the European election as an election between him and Marine Le Pen. I mean, don't forget that when the president is elected in principle in the Fifth Republic, he's the president of all people, like probably in the United States, at least in principle. So he's not supposed to take side in the European election. Here he took side, and so it's very clever from his point of view, because he polarized the debate between him and the National Front, or the National Gathering, now it's called. But anyway, the National Front. And of course, that way he lost the National Front, but not very much so. And then he's certain to be reelected in 2022, because what will happen, it will be again between him and the far right, and the far right will come even maybe in the first place in the first round, but they are bound to lose in the second round because every Green will vote for Macron, or the left will vote for Macron, always on the basis that we have to stop fascism, which is silly, but anyway. And then he's bound to be reelected. That's his tactic. He has actually swallowed part of the left in the part, the soft left or the socialist left in the presidential election, and now he has swallowed some of the right because he has given so much money to the rich people that the right doesn't care about values and all these things and doesn't care about gay marriage or something like that, which Macron supports, and then they like their tax break and then they vote for Macron. The Republicans, which is the traditional right-wing party, has lost a lot of vote to Macron because they, and of course the National Front, but they lost to Macron. For example, in Paris, it's very striking that all the bourgeois neighborhoods, which were like the 16 arrondissements, if you know that, and so on, I mean, they're very rich and bourgeois, they voted for Macron rather than for the Republicans because Macron is so right-wing on an economic point of view. But then, of course, since the left is going to gather around Macron against Le Pen in the second round, he's bound to be elected. So there's nothing you can do. And the left destroyed itself by refusing to deal with the issue of sovereignty. They refuse it. They just refuse. They call it fascist, racist, and so on. But the United States is not a country. Even the left in the United States is not going to renounce the national sovereignty of the United States. I wish the United States stayed home and didn't interfere with other countries, but I certainly don't think they should be a sovereign country.
Now, I'm wondering if you can also expand your analysis to what happened in Britain just before the European Union elections. You had Theresa May announce her resignation from her party in a lead up to stepping down as prime minister. And she has been roiled by her inability to come up with a proper Brexit deal, and Brexit being very much in line with this idea of and essentially Brexit being the UK's narrow decision to leave the EU and in a way sort of reclaim the sovereignty that you're talking about. But of course, the parties that push that are very right-wing. How did the EU election results reflect what's happening specifically in the UK?
Well, in the UK, I think it's again the fault of the left. You see, the Blairite left has been totally for the European Union. And people didn't like that. And then, of course, there was Brexit. And then they, instead of implementing Brexit, they sort of delayed it and tried to avoid it. And then the European Union did everything to sabotage it. So the European Union is really a prison of the people, like the Russian Empire or the Turkish Empire and so on of the past. They really want people to not to leave the club if they want to. And don't forget that in 2005, both France and Holland refused the European Constitution by a referendum, and then it was imposed on them by the parliament. It's exactly the same thing that's happening with Brexit. The parliament is against Brexit, the people are for, and so they vote, they try to delay it. And the Labour Party is divided. I think Corbyn has probably the heart in the right place, and he's probably in favor of Brexit, but he can't
Jeremy
do it.
Jeremy Corbyn, yeah.
Because the majority of his party is against it, of the parliament, of the parliamentary Labour Party. So it's very difficult for him to deal with that. And then, of course, they are losing the election to Farage. I agree Farage is horrible. But Farage is for the will of the people. So what do you do? I mean, it's suicidal for the left to go against the will of the majority of its people. You can try to change their mind, but you can't just go flatly against it by maneuver or denouncing them and irritating them, calling them fascists and so on. And that's true also with the Trump supporters, probably true in Brazil, although there I don't know the situation. I think it's totally suicidal for the left, and there's a lot of intellectual left, petit bourgeois left, who is totally constantly denouncing its own people as being racist and sexist and anti-Semitic. Well, that's the favorite joke, anti-Semitic. And it's just totally suicidal, and we see the suicide in action now.
So you suggest that doing so ends up making that faction dig its heels in even harder and actually harden the right's power.
Exactly.
I want to pick up on what you were saying earlier about the left kind of not in Europe, not going far enough on pushing for a socialist agenda. So you have the Greens, who seem to be closer to the centrist parties. Is there a popular will, as far as you can tell, in various European countries to strengthen the socialist parts of their governments, given that the current system has really, not helped most Europeans? The austerity measures of the past decades have devastated many economies.
Yeah, but you see, again, this has to do with national sovereignty comes first, because how are you going to have a socialist program in a country which, by treaty, is forced to have, of course, not too much deficit? But then, I don't like deficits anyway, but it has the common currency, which is the euro. The Germans want the currency to be strong because they didn't give up the mark for it to be weak. If your currency has to be strong and your economy is not as efficient as the German economy, what do you do to keep that currency strong? Well, you do internal devaluation, which means cutting pension, salaries, and so on. There is just no alternative. It's true, in that case, there is no alternative. So you have to go out of the euro. Going out of the euro would be inflationary, it would be lots of problems. You see, before the euro, all the currencies like the French franc, the German, the Deutschmark, the Italian lira, and so on, they all fluctuated, okay? And they devaluated and they changed. And since my youth, for example, the lira changed by a factor of 4 relative to the Belgian franc, the French franc changed by a factor of 3 relative to the Deutschmark, and so on. So how do you stop these money, these currencies fluctuating with respect to each other. Well, how do you stop that once you have the euro, which means they have the same parity, they have the same exchange rate? How do you do that? Well, you do that if there's really a united state of Europe. And I think they did the euro thinking that that would force a United States of Europe, but didn't happen at all. When the Greek crisis occurred, there was nobody on the German, even the German left wanted to pay for the Greeks, and it would be impossible for them to do that. So it was the same thing throughout Europe, that nobody wanted to pay. I mean, nobody is going to pay for the others, and then, you're stuck with this strong currency, and you just can't refuse the austerity measure if you don't accept also to go out of the euro. People don't want that, then the austerity continues.
So in a way, does the European Union's economic structure have baked into it an inability to control one's own economy, which has hamstrung a lot of European governments from actually helping their own people?
Of course, you're stuck with the euro. You're stuck with rules that prevent, for example, national development. You are prevented from having, except through the free market, from having an industrial policy. You know, the Gaulle, for example, initiated an industrial policy, and all the big things that work in France go back to the 60s when he developed aeronautics, aerospatial, and so on, nuclear energy. All these things would be impossible now. I gave a talk recently. I said, suppose we didn't have social security, which we did have after the war within each nation state, okay? And we had somebody like Sanders who wants to establish it like Sanders wants to have it in the United States. Well, in Europe, it would just be impossible. It would go against the treaties. Of course, since it's there, it's not so easy to dismantle it, but you can starve it, you see? If the state is in deficit, if the trade balance is in deficit, if everything goes down the drain, then in the end you'll have to cut Social Security. And in practice, that's what is done by, cutting on education, cutting on hospital and so on. Because formally you can still go to the hospital and it's still free, but good luck. I mean, even in France, which used to have a very good system, I just went to hospital recently, and good luck if you want to go to the hospital. It's not what it used to be.
Well, Jean, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insight with us on the results of the EU elections. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
My guest has been Jean Bricmont, joining us from Paris, France. He's a retired mathematical and statistical physicist at the University of Louvain. His book is Humanitarian Imperialism, Using Human Rights to Sell War. He's also co-authored Fashionable Nonsense, Postmodern Intellectuals' Abuse of Science. We've been discussing the results of the EU elections. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.